Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Imagine that Abraham Lincoln survived that infamous night in Ford's Theater, only to eventually meet the same fate that awaited Andrew Johnson, impeachment for alleged high crimes and misdemeanors. In Stephen Carter's new novel, The Impeachment of Abraham Lincoln, the man we know as the Great Emancipator imprisons critics, invokes martial law, suspends the writ of habeas corpus, and throttles the press, all to win the Civil War. Stephen Carter is the William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Law at Yale University, where he has taught since 1982. He is the author of 8 books of nonfiction, 5 novels, including The Emperor of Ocean Park and Palace Council. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Professor Stephen Carter to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. I appreciate you having me on.
So what brought you to the idea of Lincoln being impeached?
I've been a Lincoln fan, and I want to make that clear, given the name of my book, that I am a Lincoln fan. I've been a Lincoln fan since I was a little boy reading books from my father's bookshelf about Abraham Lincoln. But I've always wondered. We used to argue about it, I remember, in high school, and I wrote something about it in college. I've always wondered how much of our image of Lincoln is caught up in the fact of his assassination. What might his life have been like, his career have been like, his legacy have been like, had he survived? And it's a book I've always wanted to write. I finally decided to take some time off from my other writing. It took me 3 years, 4 years. And so I wrote this story, the idea of putting a courtroom thriller around Lincoln's possible impeachment, in the end was, I guess, too tempting to resist.
One of the things that I found fascinating about the book is actually how rarely Lincoln is speaking in the book. Those are rare moments. This is, and we'll get into the other characters in the novel, but there are 4, 5, 6 scenes or so that Lincoln is there. What is it like to write the words of Abraham Lincoln?
I'm glad you started out the question the way you did, because although this novel is called The Impeachment of Abraham Lincoln, I didn't want to write just another novel with Lincoln as a central character, of which there have been many over the years. So my story is told from the point of view of an outsider, a young black woman named Abigail Canner, who's observing and to some extent distantly participating in these great events. I spent a lot of time with Lincoln's speeches and letters, and also in various biographies and studies of Lincoln, trying to get a sense of his cadence, what his voice actually sounded like, as opposed to just his words. And from that, I tried to construct words to put into his mouth. Obviously, they're inventions, but I tried to be as true to life as I could.
You have used real figures in the past in your work. Is this the deepest foray into what is termed alternate fiction?
It is. I know my novel Palace Council, Richard Nixon appears as a character,
right,
and he's in probably 3 or 4 scenes. He's a minor character until late in the book. I have never worked as hard on the research, on trying to get the history right, even though it's alternate history, as I did with this book. And in part, it's because I respect the subject so much, Lincoln, and I respect the era so much. The Civil War era and the Reconstruction era are areas of my scholarly interest and areas also of my amateur historical interest. And I spend a lot of time reading about them and writing about them. And so it's my respect for the age and for the man I was writing about that led me to be as careful as I possibly could.
How slippery a term is that, alternate history?
Well, there's a sense in which every novel is alternate history, isn't there?
Right.
That is, every novel is the willed imagination of the author. And this one, in that sense, is no different. But when I, as a novelist, or any novelist, takes upon himself or herself the presumption, and it is a presumption, to take major historical events and rework their order, not just to serve a narrative, but to create a new narrative, that is pretty presumptuous. I admit that. And maybe some people even said it was a little daring of me. I don't know. But I will tell you this, it was a lot of fun.
So it's more of a what-if book.
That's the idea. And it's important to make that clear. Although the novel is called The Impeachment of Abraham Lincoln, although it revolves around a hypothetical trial of Abraham Lincoln, I am not saying Abraham Lincoln would have been impeached. I certainly am not saying he should have been impeached. I'm just wondering what it might have looked like if his political enemies, and he had many, had decided to gang up and try to impeach him. And that's what leads to the story.
The line in the book, he had been shot on Good Friday, on Easter Sunday, he rose. So in this book, there's about three quarters to an inch that keeps the president alive.
It's true. The novel begins on the night of Booth's shooting of Lincoln, and there the history diverges that, yes, in real life, he, of course, died. But what I do is I take the story of Ford's Theater and the events outside Ford's Theater as historians best understand them, and I keep them pretty much the same. That is to say, what happened that night and into Saturday morning is largely what really happened that night and Saturday morning. The difference is, when Saturday morning comes, instead of breathing his last, the president begins to strengthen. And by page three of the novel, he is sitting up and he's survived the assassination attempt. By the way, in my story, Andrew Johnson, the vice president, is murdered that night. The conspirators who murdered Lincoln were supposed to murder Andrew Johnson. This is in real life. But the guy who was assigned that job got cold feet and he got drunk instead and never actually tried. In my story, Booth fails and the assassin sent to kill the vice president succeeds.
One of the things that I found so striking about the novel, and as you said, so much has been written about this man, but we are reminded, obviously, about this great man, the great emancipator, but we're also reminded of what a political animal he is. And that is really striking.
Abraham Lincoln had some of the greatest political talents I think we've ever had. And by political talents, I don't mean as a campaigner. In fact, in those days, it was considered unseemly for presidents to campaign for office, and they didn't do it. But he had a remarkable talent to bring competing forces together, to persuade opponents over to his side, but also to figure out in advance what other people were planning and work behind the scenes to sabotage their various conspiracies, something he was remarkably good at. He was probably better at that kind of anticipating his opponents and, if you will, cutting off at the pass than any president we've had. And so I tried to keep those qualities in the story, that you see Lincoln, the backroom bargainer, and you also see Lincoln trying to figure out what his opponents are up to and trying to get there first.
You say in the novel that upon his living through the shooting, of saying across the nation people cheered, those who felt otherwise kept their disappointment to themselves, content to bide their time. And as you mentioned earlier, here was a man not popular within his own party, and these were people who would be considered progressives.
No, that's right, and it's a forgotten aspect of Lincoln's life and career that there were many people in his own party, the Republican Party at the time, the Anti-Slavery Party, who looked down their nose at him. That's the only way to put it. The party tended to be dominated, at least in its upper ranks, by educated Easterners. And Lincoln had no formal education. He had a funny accent. He told a lot of funny and folksy stories. He was not their kind of politician, and they also thought he was not sufficiently committed to abolition. Even some thought he was not the right man to lead the nation in time of war. As late as 1864, they were still trying to shun him aside so that, as one of them said, a fitter man could take his place. So in my story, those very people, the leaders of his party, those who in real life were eulogizing him after his assassination, in my story, they turn against him in the years after the war. And we have a long history of turning against our presidents after wars, that when a war is over, or sometimes not even when it's over, late in a war, especially a war that drags on, and certainly when it's over, there's always been a tendency in our history to punish somehow the president who has led us into war, who's leading us at the time. And Lincoln himself was aware of that and talked about that possibility a lot. He wasn't talking about impeachment. He was just wondering what kind of punishment he himself was likely to suffer.
His critics, did they not see him morally as good as they were?
I think a lot of people didn't. So if you take someone like Samuel Chase, who desperately wanted to be president, Lincoln was nominated when Chase hoped to be nominated in 1860. Chase became Secretary of Treasury, conspired against Lincoln from the Treasury. was ultimately forced to resign out of the cabinet, although he later, Lincoln appointed him Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, but he still kept trying to run for president from the court. I think Chase, to his dying day, believed that Lincoln was a lesser man morally, and so did many of Chase's friends and supporters, and he was very far from the only one who had that view of Lincoln.
You also remind us of that moral journey that Lincoln took to get to his point of view, which was not his thought originally.
No, that's right. And nowadays, when people talk about Lincoln, there's a kind of story that goes around, which isn't entirely fair to Lincoln. There's a story that goes around that says, well, really, he was a racist and he didn't care about slavery and so on. I think that the Columbia historian Eric Foner gets it right when he says there are things in Lincoln to admire and things in Lincoln to despise, and we should take the ones to admire. Lincoln changed a lot over the years. The early Lincoln, who vacillated on slavery and so on, is replaced by 1863-64 by a Lincoln who's clearly committed to abolition. People debate whether he was committed to social equality or not. That's another question. He's clearly committed to abolition, and the war that began for him as a war to save the Union has become a war to end slavery.
We're talking to Stephen Carter, author of the book The Impeachment of Abraham Lincoln, published by Knopf. Let us talk about Abigail Canner, 21 years old, black, grew up in the District of Columbia, and we get a glimpse of a black middle class, a black middle class in America before the Civil War that I don't think many of us knew existed.
I had a lot of fun coming up with Abigail's character and filling her out a bit. As you say, she's 21 years old. She's black. She wants to be a lawyer. She's a graduate of Oberlin, and Oberlin at the time did educate both women and people of color alongside the white male students who populated most colleges of the day. She wants to be a lawyer. At this time, there are no female lawyers in America, although the first woman to sit for the bar, to try to take the bar exam, was 1868. A year after my story, but there are no lawyers in America, or women, and probably six or seven, we don't know the precise number, who were black at the time. I created Abigail in part because I wanted the story, the mystery and the thriller aspects both, to revolve around an outsider, someone who wasn't one of the powerful people who tend to dominate novels written about that period. But also for the reason that you suggest, that we don't think about or talk a lot about the black middle class of that time. There were actually tens of thousands of black people in that era who had jobs or little businesses and so on who hadn't just come out of slavery. Slavery is our greatest national scar and horror, but the story, and we should never forget that story, but the story of the black middle class of that time, people who sometimes for several generations had been free and had been earning a living, is also a story that needs to be told. And Abigail doesn't live in any fancy way. She lives in a little house down in Southwest Washington with her great aunt, who's a former slave, and her sister. And they have a little farm that they work, and her sister goes to school. And they were raised to be ambitious, to move ahead. And that was what I was trying to illustrate, how a young one of ambition, a young black one of ambition, would navigate those rocky shoals of Washington and its social conventions of the time.
It does seem to be a recurring theme in your collected work that there were always African Americans that possessed more power, more money than white Americans would realize.
I suppose that's fair, that I have always been fascinated by that strata of African-American history. It's probably a little bit autobiographical. My father was a lawyer. My grandmother was a lawyer. She was a black woman lawyer in New York in the 1930s. And her grandfather was a former slave who moved to Canada and prospered in small business there. And growing up with these family stories probably influenced my choice of subject quite a bit. But there's something more also, that I think that there's a failure of imagination in America sometimes when we talk about the history of black America. And you see it especially in literature and in film, where you very rarely nowadays meet black characters who are more than one generation out of something terrible, whatever it may be. So that even though on television now you have black doctors and lawyers and judges and so on, for instance, if you know anything about their lives at all, you almost always discover the tragic circumstances in which they grew up. They're never second or third generation college-educated people, black people on television and the movies, even though there's an awful lot of them in the United States.
I think Abigail is such a neat character because she doesn't even want to be a lawyer. There really is not that. She knows she wants to go and do something good, and she comes and says, "I'm going to make a change." And it's that wonderful time in your early 20s where life hasn't really slapped you upside the head
possible.
Yet.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. No, that's right. That while she conceptualizes it as wanting to be a lawyer, really what she wants to do is do something important. And we're told that when we first meet her, that she has a sense that somehow she ought to be involved in great events. And it's really interesting that Oberlin College, it was then called Oberlin Collegiate Institute, of the 1850s and 1860s, was a place that actually tried very hard to make its students want to be part of something big and important. Now, at the time, it was really abolitionism. They were really training students and sending them to be great abolitionists. But nevertheless, a lot of young people who are smart and know that they're capable come out of college and go through that period of saying, well, I'm going to do something important in the world. And it was interesting to me to wonder what that would be like if you were a young black woman in the 1860s, with that same feeling as all the other people spilling out of college at the time might have felt. Because the novel also includes a murder mystery component, and because it's also meant to be a courtroom thriller, I wanted her to have this ambition, but also for us to see how smart she was by the way that she interacts, not so much with great legal theories, she's never studied law, but her role in helping to solve the mystery, her role in helping in Lincoln's defense in various indirect ways. I wanted us not to be told how smart and capable she is, but to see on the pages how smart and capable she is.
And as she rises, and as this character and this woman becomes fully formed, what's fascinating is, okay, welcome to Washington, because her enemies and her suitors are pretty much the same.
One of the things that Abigail encounters as she moves into a certain social circle of people in Washington, she does run into a number of suitors. And actually, this was not that unusual. There were cases at the time of black women from well-to-do families who had white suitors. Now, she has white and black suitors, but that was not as unusual as one might think. But nevertheless, there were these constant barriers, places she either couldn't go or just was suspected of something whenever she goes, including the first day she shows up for work at the law firm, where people assume she's a messenger bringing a message from someone else.
The novel, as I mentioned, is The Impeachment of Abraham Lincoln by Stephen Carter. And let us talk about the impeachment. Mentioned this in the introduction, imprisoned critics, invoked martial law, suspends the writ of habeas corpus, throttles the press. Should he have been impeached? You said before that you're not making the argument one way or the other, but there is a lot of ammunition.
There is a lot of ammunition. However, it's important to put it in context. In my hypothetical impeachment trial, Lincoln faces four charges, and I don't want to give them all away, but the first two are clearly true. He's charged with suspending habeas corpus, which he did. Habeas corpus is often described as the most ancient of the rights in the Anglo-Saxon world, the right to be charged with a crime and bound over to a court if you're detained by your government. And Lincoln suspended that with the stroke of a pen, and when courts ordered on more than one occasion people held in federal custody to be discharged, Lincoln simply refused. That really did happen. What also really did happen was that Lincoln's administration did shut down a number of opposition newspapers, although Lincoln overturned some of those decisions, didn't overturn all of them. Some journalists really were sent to prison. Others were given courts-martial and exiled from the front if the generals didn't like the stories that they were writing. All those things really happened. And there were a lot of other things as well. And whenever Lincoln was challenged about this, including friendly challenges by his supporters, his reply, stripped of the frills, was basically this: the nation is under threat. I will do whatever I have to do to win the war. That was basically his argument. One reason that I find that argument striking, and one reason I invite the reader to think through these charges and think about Lincoln, is that every president who's fought a war has done things that we've found distasteful, and a lot of things have been quite horrible. A lot of things have been quite horrible. But presidents who do them, I think, are always thinking, rightly or wrongly, I'm doing what I have to do to win the war. And Lincoln is another in that line of presidents who did distasteful things in order, in his own judgment, to win the war.
You take away that the egotism, and you take away that layer of evil, I guess, when you look at why a president would act that way, and you look at the wartime conduct of presidents in that period in the 19th century, compare it to the wartime conduct of presidents today, and the presidents today would pale in comparison, and yet we bandy that impeachment word around quite a bit.
I think that's right. I think that we too often discuss what presidents do in war without any great sense of history to guide us, and I think that's a mistake. On the other hand, as some of my colleagues point out at Yale Law School, when we argue about these things, the powers of the presidency and the nature of the rights we possess were still being worked out. The United States was quite young at the time of the Civil War, one has to remember, and we have a clearer vision now, perhaps, of what presidents should or shouldn't be allowed to do. Nevertheless, I do think that it is worth all of us taking the time to answer the following question. If we really believed we were in a war for the nation's survival, if we really thought America is going to end if we lose, and we really believed that, what would we be willing to do to win? That, I think, is the question that Lincoln confronts, and he gives a particular answer. And although my novel is meant mainly to be fun and I hope a good read, I also invite the reader along that journey to think about the things that Lincoln actually did and decide for himself or herself.
The issue of not why or how he did it, but the key being what he did.
That Lincoln is an icon today, we would all agree. Every politician, certainly every president, invokes Lincoln all the time. And I think that's fine. I think Lincoln deserves iconic status. But we do have to separate our admiration of Lincoln, which is nearly universal, I hope, in America, from that question that you just mentioned, from the concrete acts that he committed. It cannot be the case that suspending habeas corpus is right if Lincoln does it, but wrong if anyone else does it. That's not a real argument. One has to have a consistent view on that. And in the book, although it's true that his political enemies in the book are going to be his enemies anyway, and they don't care about these charges except if the charges are persuasive. So I do imagine a conspiracy behind all this. Nevertheless, that doesn't mean that none of the charges actually raise serious questions that ought to be dealt with.
And ultimately, when you look at Lincoln, he grew up as a hero to you and in your family. That view has not changed.
Not at all. In fact, in certain ways, working on this novel has increased my respect for Lincoln, because though I've always been an avid reader of Lincoln biographies, for example, an average student amateur student perhaps of Lincoln, and so I've always had a sense of the great things he did, writing this book has given me a greater sense, perhaps, of the agonized quality of a lot of the decisions he had to make. The things that he did, which are controversial and which I write about, were not easy decisions, I believe, for him to make. And going through that agony on the nation's behalf and on behalf of those who were enslaved, I think, is actually an important part of his legacy.
Stephen Carter's new novel is The Impeachment of Abraham Lincoln. It is published by Knopf. Professor Carter, a great pleasure to have you on our program. I thank you very much for being with us.
It's been fun. Thank you so much.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Thanks to the crew at WAMU in Washington, D.C. for the recording time and space for this program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.